And welcome to the Friday edition. I'm Joseph Orozco. In this Native American Heritage Month, it's fitting that we share from the Pacifica Radio Archives, Radio Free Alcatraz, recorded on November the 22nd, 1969.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, Director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. Well, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me dozens of times, and you're probably a Native American tribe signing a treaty in good faith with a representative of the United States government, ratified by the United States Senate, and broken within years of the signing. This week on From the Vault, as the Occupy movement has taken root here in America and now worldwide in November of 2011, we turn to an earlier Occupy movement that Pacifica Radio documented intimately from November 20th, 1969 to June 11th, 1971, the occupation of Alcatraz Island.
See, like, we've been here for 20,000 years before the white man ever came, and 400 years and, 70-some years he's been here. And only in the last 50 years has he really taken over, you know, with the factories, the pollution, cars, smog. And we've been here all along, and we're still here, you know, so there has to be some value. Because, you know, after they subjugated us and divided us and beat us down and beat us over the head with a Christian cross and things, we still have our culture after 400 years.
When the Alcatraz Penitentiary was closed on March 21st in 1963, Native American activists referred to the Treaty of Fort Laramie in Wyoming, signed with the Lakota, Arapaho, and Dakota tribes in 1868, which, among many other land rights, returned all retired, abandoned, or out-of-use land to the tribes from whom it was acquired. The first symbolic occupation of Alcatraz was on March 8, 1964, when Alan Cotier, Walter Means, Garfield Spotted Elk, and others publicly offered the United States government the same amount of money it paid for the Native American land, 40 cents an acre for a total of $6.54 for the 12-acre Rock Island. There were other attempts at occupying the island and bringing awareness to broken treaties and stolen lands dating back to the 1700s, but on November 20, 1969, 79 Native Americans set out to occupy Alcatraz, only to be met by a Coast Guard blockade. Only 14 students managed to slip through the blockade, and by Thanksgiving of 1969, hundreds of supporters had made their way to the island. The group called themselves the United Indians of All Tribes, and the occupation would last for almost 2 years. John Trudell became the voice of Radio Free Alcatraz, a daily broadcast that was aired on Everyday Live on Pacifica Radio KPFA 94.7 FM in Berkeley, California, and on the other three stations, WBAI in New York City and KPFK in Los Angeles, starting on December 22, 1969. Pacifica Radio KPFA produced the second of three specials on Occupy Alcatraz movement to present a detailed account of the Native American struggle to bring awareness to the United States' repeated betrayal of a people. From the KPFA folio, here is a timely description of the Occupy Alcatraz movement and KPFA's coverage of this occupation. On Monday evening, December 22nd, KPFA began its first broadcast, live and direct from Alcatraz. Under the direction of John Trudell, a young Santee Sioux from Nebraska who was trying to make a home on the island with his wife and two young children, the Alcatraz Radio Project was conceived to give a voice to the voiceless minority of Native Americans. With begged and borrowed radio equipment, the programs originate from the main cell block building on Alcatraz and are carried live by the Pacifica Network, KPFA, KPFK, and WBAI. Weekday evenings at 7:15 p.m. Radio Alcatraz is the first regularly scheduled Pacifica Network program. Some 200 Indians are occupying the island, which has no telephone connection with the mainland and only irregular boat service. Alcatraz does have a magnificent sweeping view of the Bay Area from the Berkeley Hills to the Golden Gate. It is here that the Indians have taken their stand, vowing not to be moved until they can establish an Indian university and cultural center for the nation. And that was direct from the KPFA folio, the printed schedule from February of 1970. And now here we present this December 23rd, 1969 special on the Alcatraz occupation on From the Vault.
This is Al Silverwoods, the station manager at KPFA, and this is the Pacifica Network. Tonight, we present the second in our continuing series of reports from Alcatraz. Alcatraz is a rocky and forbidding island situated in San Francisco Bay, with a commanding view of San Francisco and the Golden Gate. Before it became the infamous maximum security federal prison known as the Rock, it was the site of an old fort, the dungeons of which still honeycomb the foundations of the main cell block building. At present, it remains the home of a government caretaker and his family. Although electrical power, telephone, and supplies of fresh water have been cut off, the Indians, some 200 of them now, on Alcatraz are maintaining themselves with the aid of a fishing boat that shuttles back and forth between Pier 47 near Fisherman's Wharf and the island's single and difficult-to-negotiate landing. The boat maintains an hourly schedule for the 10-minute trip, ferrying supplies and people to the disputed island. U.S. government property signs on the island have been painted over in red and now read Indian Territory and Red Power. The Indians first staked their claim to the island on March 9, 1964, after it was officially abandoned as a federal prison. Five Sioux men claimed Alcatraz on the basis of an 1868 treaty made by the U.S. government with the Sioux. Among other things, the treaty provided that unused federal lands could be claimed by Sioux braves. Since its abandonment by the government, Alcatraz has proved a thorny problem as the federal government and the city of San Francisco have sought a use for the island. Schemes have ranged from turning it into a bird sanctuary to the proposal made by H.L. Hunt, the wealthy Texas oil man, to build a towering monument and restaurant on it. Now, after a hiatus of 5 years, the Indians have reasserted their claim and vow that they will not be removed. We will take you to Alcatraz, but first a moment of introductory music from Buffy St. Marie, then live and direct from Alcatraz.
Can you remember the time that you have held your head high and told all your friends of your Indian claim? Proud good lady and proud good man, your great-great-grandfather from Indian blood sprang, and you feel in your heart for these ones. Oh, it's written in books and in songs that we've been mistreated and wronged. Well, over and over.
Good evening, this is John Trudell welcoming you to Radio Free Alcatraz, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Indians of all tribes. Tonight we'll be speaking with Mrs. Stella Leach and Mr. Gabriel Sharp, Mr. Raymond Spang. Mrs. Leach is a member of the Colville Sioux tribes. She's a registered nurse and a council member on the island. She runs the clinic here on the island, and she took a 3-month leave of absence from her job at the Well Baby Clinic in San Francisco to work with the people on the island. She's been here with Operation Alcatraz from the very beginning. And Mr. Gabriel Sharp is a Mojave, and he's a member of the Colorado River tribes of Parker, Arizona. His occupation is he's a counselor for Indian high school students, the assistant director of All Indian Upward Bound program at the Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona, and he's the chairman of education for the Arizona Indian Association. And Ray Spang is a Northern Cheyenne, 19 years old. He's a student at UCLA, taking sociology, mental health, and law. And he's a member of the council here on the island, and he was a member of the invading group the 20th of November. And I will start off the questioning with Ray. Ray, what would you like to see take place on the island?
Yeah, well, I think I'd like to see a Native American university, which would include not only classroom discussion, but actually involve the students and the teachers going out to the communities and relating, or trying to make their education, what they learn in the classroom, relevant, and, you know, going out in the field and seeing how stuff works. And, you know, just relating or tying the two together, rather than see, like, I'm from Montana, and I went out to out east for a while, and I was, you know, completely cut off from my tribe and the people back home. I didn't know what was going on. But then if I see down in LA, then I got the community around there, and get involved in that. We can work with the community, and they can have a direct say over what the students at the university do, and sort of tie in the two together and work from there. rather than, you know, having them go on their way and we go on our way. And hopefully, you know, by another time, 10 years or so, we'll meet somewhere or other.
Stella?
Yes.
Say.
What would I like to see on Alcatraz? I'd like to see the dreams of all these young people that took this island come true. If the university is what they want, then I'm all for it. Whatever pleases our young people, because to me this is the greatest thing that has ever occurred in my generation to these young people, to see our Indian youth take their place in society and once again become warriors in our society, men in the world.
Mr. Sharp, same question.
What I would like to see Alcatraz become would be in the minds of those people called Native Americans. I believe that we are always talking about dreams. Some people call dreams, and some people call these dreams imagination. And by our mind power and thoughts, we can create. I see a beautiful dream here on Alcatraz in terms of a piece of earth that God gave to the Indians will revert back to the Indians, and out of this will grow something positive that really is Indians, that belongs to the Indians. And it's not government control or state control or controlled by other peoples, but something that really belongs to the Indian himself. This is a dream that I feel that some of these youngsters came on this island to create, to work with these ideas, and it's a beautiful dream.
I'd like to go back to what Stella mentioned about this is the first time that we have done anything as a group. Well, the youth have gotten together. And why do you think that this is the first time that we have ever really gotten together and done something in the national eye so that the public is aware of what we are doing, the circumstances leading up to this?
Well, in my lifetime, I've always found that the bureaucracies that controlled the Indians' destiny has always impressed upon the Indian that they could never get together. The tribes, there was such a basic difference between our tribal cultures and our philosophies that we could never unite. Well, here on this island, you can see about 70 different tribes working with each other in friendship and complete cooperation. And of course, this is very, very fascinating to me to prove to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and other establishments that once again they are wrong, that Indians primarily are the same. We are all Indians underneath, regardless of our culture or our geography.
Yeah, I did some reading on this, some books on Indians, and I read that the government started a policy several decades ago, a couple hundred years ago, of breaking down the Indian, not only as a nation, but as a tribe, as a family, as an individual, and they did this job and they accomplished what they set out to do very well for a certain period of time. But I like to believe that they took our lands away. I don't like to believe this, but they did take our lands. But I like to believe that we haven't been defeated. I think this is the first really big chance we've had to show that we're still together and that we're willing to work together. And this is something that other people have got to learn to do. And it's taken us a long time, and there's a lot for us to do, but we're in the right direction. Ray, do you have any comments to add to this?
Well, I don't know. I don't like to think of ourselves as being defeated either. And I look at things factually, because, you know, the United States has stolen land, and they still are stealing land. They still got the reservations. They still have prejudiced teachers. The educational standards are, on the fifth grade level? I mean, after 400 years, on a fifth grade level. We've got the lowest death rate, and, you know, all these statistics. And people say, you know, they think of them as being in the past century. They say, well, my dad might have, you know, participated, my grandfather might have, but not today, you know. But if you go back to any of the reservations and just look around, live there for a week, and, you know, you find out it's true. It's, you know, it's really bad. And about this dying out, see, like, we've been here for 20,000 years before the white men ever came, and 400 years and, what, 70-some years he's been here, and only in the last 50 years has he's really taken over, you know, with the factories, the pollution, cars, smog, birth control pills, then the race question is coming up. And see, in 50 years, the white man is really messed up. And we've been here all along, and we're still here, you know, so there has to be some value. Because, you know, after they subjugated and divided us and beat us down and beat us over the head with a Christian cross and things, we still have our culture after 400 years. I mean, you know, where else is there another people who has been so subjugated and so small and yet still to retain so much?
The only other people I can think of that would fit into this category would be the Jewish people. And they have seemed to, what it has taken them about 400 years to kind of get things going for them. But that's the only other people I know of this really happening with that have taken a lot from a lot of harassment, I guess, from other peoples and other races, because we as a nation have suffered more. We're the only people to ever fight the United States government and suffer and pay for it continuously, even though the wars are supposedly long gone and over. We pay for it every day. And I would like Mr. Sharp to, he was talking on the boat on the way over here today about an incident that happened with Lee Brightman, and I would like to have Mr. Sharp give us the details on this.
Mr. Brightman came over to Arizona, I believe it was sometime in November. He got an invitation from the Phoenix area, and I work at the university in one of the offices, one of the Indian offices. So Mr. Brightman came to our office. He was a fellow Indian, brought him over, and he talked to my boss. I'm assistant director of the All Indian Upward Bound, and my boss is the director. So I wouldn't mention names here, but after Mr. Brightman left our office, we got a call from the hierarchy of the university wanting to know who invited this guy. Another interesting part to this is Mr. Brightman was taken over to the Indian Community Action Program office, which deals works with Indians in Arizona and California and New Mexico, and they got a call from the governor's office, the governor of Arizona. One of his boys called down to the Indian Community Action headquarters, wanting to know who invited this Mr. Brightman. And also that a suggestion was made that the Indians in Arizona were being treated very well. And this was quite interesting to me, because I've been working in Indian affairs for a number of years, and I've lived on reservations, and I've seen some of the conditions there on reservations, on the Havasupai Reservation. I was working there for a number of years in the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and you would see a five-year-old youngster having for breakfast a dried-up old tortilla that they had the night before and a cup of coffee, and this would go on morning after morning. And I guess at that time I lived in a nice white house, and boy, did my conscience bother me. Well, this type of conditions exist all over in Arizona, in some of the 17 reservations there. And but I think that the most interesting part was the comment saying that Arizona Indians are being helped. After people trying to help Arizona Indians since the Indian Reorganization Act and since we greeted the pilgrims, we still haven't gotten any place. I just wonder if who is really trying to help who.
It's a Very, very good question there. We have to take about a 10-second pause here for station identification, and this broadcast is being brought by the Pacifica Network. And now local stations will identify themselves.
KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley.
Okay, we're back here. We're with Stella Leach, Mr. Gabriel Sharp, and Raymond Spang. And I think better explain who Lee Brightman is. Stella, you're a little more familiar with Lee. Would you care to?
Well, Lee heads the United Native American Group, and which is comprised primarily of college and university level students. He is one of the most well-known activists, I think, in the United States, and his main interest, of course, is the betterment of his people, not only through the educational level, but also so through the nutritional and health levels.
I've only heard Mr. Brightman speak one time. This was at the California Educational Forum for California Indians in Riverside about a month ago. And he's a very effective speaker. He gets his point across.
Yeah, that's while he's doing this, and so perhaps that's what the governor of Arizona was concerned about. Maybe he was afraid his toes were going to be stepped on.
Mr. Sharp brought up the point about who is helping who. And there are many well-meaning people, I think, out on the outside society that would like to help us, and maybe in many ways don't know how. But it seems to me that we have two different cultures, and many people that want to help the Indian people, they want to help us, but they want us to do it their way. They don't want to give us any free hand and let us work on our own. They don't seem to realize that we have brains and feelings, and we're human beings, and we can function just as well as anyone else. You know, we're not gods, but we're not devils. We're just everyday human beings with a culture and a history of our own that we would like to be able to bring out. Have you ever run into any well-meaning people, Ray, that have maybe kind of loused things up?
Yeah, well, I think I ran into a lot, and most common are the type of well-to-do rich white lady whose husband has a big car and, you know, 2.4 children, things like this. And she usually, you know, goes around with her society friends and, you know, collecting up $10 here and there and then sending it to some organization or to some family or even to some reservation. But then on the reservation, you don't know what happens to it. It's either ripped off in a tribal council or, you know, some other people get their hands into it. Then, you know, it really doesn't get down where it's going. If the people were really interested in getting the money out there, they would get themselves together. And also, when they organize, they shouldn't go around saying, well, we're going to save the Indian people. You know, they should just do about it quietly and matter-of-factly and get it done. And another thing is when there comes a plea from some reservation for help, one of the first things they send is a lot of used old clothing. And, you know, it's going to cover up our reservation. So we don't need that. And some of the tribes are even kicking around the idea of starting a ceremony called the old clothes burning ceremony.
In many cases, that's about the only way some of these old clothes will keep us warm, too. It's just have a big bonfire and get them all out of the way at once. Mr. Gabriel, or Mr. Sharp, you're as an educator. What do you think about our educational program here and what we are setting up?
I've been reading over what the proposal here, and the potential is there. The Center for Native American Studies, it's great. It's a great idea. Let me give you a specific example of what we do in working with high school students, sophomore to senior level, between ages 15 to 20. I think that somewhere along this line there are a lot of Indian students who have been going to school, public school, and don't really know what their tribes are. And every human being has to answer the question to within himself. He has to know, who am I? You know, who am I? What is my purpose on this earth? You know, I think all we Indians know what our purpose is and we know what our potential is. This is what makes us so in harmony and so relaxed. Now, I think that along your proposals here, it's tremendous. You have here an American Indian Spiritual Center. I could go into this for hours because I have been indoctrinated into the spiritual realm of Mojave philosophy, and I guess some—I hate to use this word—but white people believe in heaven. We Indians know there's more than one heaven. There's about four, and the Navajos seven heavens, and the Hopis 12. My goodness, you know. So there's an area to be explored. I just can't talk enough about this. The American Indian Museum, this is an idea that is present on all reservations. The idea is always there. I think that this would be I just can't say enough about this. The potential is here, and I love the idea, and it's going to work in terms of education. There's no limit. There is no limit.
Thank you. Stella, would you please tell us how you happened to be here and when you first found out about the Alcatraz movement?
Well, I was aware for some time that our young people were planning on landing on Alcatraz. And of course, I was all in favor of this. I didn't feel that at my age that I would take part in any of this. But on the second day after the landing, I felt that perhaps some of our people may need medical attention. So with the assistance of Dr. Tepper, who is the director of our All-Indian Well Baby Clinic in Oakland, we fixed up first aid kits, and I attempted to come aboard the island. Of course, at that time, the blockade was on, and I had to come in escorted by the United States Marshal. And so shortly after I arrived, while the clinic was put in commission, and we found that there was a need for it here, because then the families began to come onto the island and more people were getting through the blockade. And of course, food and water situation was quite serious for the first 4 or 5 days. And so I stayed. And finally, I got a 3 months leave of absence and remained on the island permanently. And of course, my employer, Dr. Tepper, has since then given 1 day a week to our clinic here on the island, and it might be interesting to the people that are listening to know that we have a doctor that comes every day, and six of these doctors are Jewish, and the seventh one is Greek, Dr. Chalice, and these are all people that have come from an oppressed background, and I feel that they are sympathetic to us, and this is the reason that they have participated so wholeheartedly. And of course, there are other doctors and nurses in the community that have donated large quantities of medical supplies, and these we are very happy to receive.
That brings to mind right after about the first 2 weeks after the occupation of the island, that the GSA and the Public Health Department made threats to remove us from the island because of improper sanitation facilities on the island. They made statements that they may have to remove us. And that kind of struck me as being rather funny, because they let us live on reservations under the same circumstances, and they haven't threatened to improve these conditions or drag us off and make things better for us. But all of a sudden we're on this island and they want to do this for the people that are on the island, and somehow I just don't think that we would benefit all that much from it. Ray, what is it like on your reservation at home?
My reservation is mentioned in the New Indians, and it's a small town. It's in a valley. It's a population of maybe 1,000. We've got a state highway coming through, dividing the town into two. One side's agency controlled, meaning they've got shutters and lawns and cars and sidewalks. And then on the other side, there's a craft cattle guard in between there. And on the other side, we've got the highway. Then we've got the town. Then above the town, we've got three main areas of where the people live. And so there's three groups, the Indians and the townspeople and then the agency people. And there's a lot of, fighting among the agency kids and the Indian kids and the white kids. There was anyway, and now it's a little bit more covert than it was. And we do have Indians who work for the BIA, and they stay on the agency side. And, you know, among all the Indians, there's a current term called, well, it has been passed, called agency kids, you know, referring to the Indian kids who lived on the agency side, who are brown, or little brown Americans, essentially. You know, they have no culture, they don't associate with the Indians because the Indians are Indians, you know, whatever that connotes to them. And we have, what, about 2 gas stations, 1 store, about 12 religions, and 1 main street. That's about it.
You're listening to Radio Free Alcatraz from the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Gabriel, would you give us a little background on the reservation that's your home?
If I'm from the Colorado River Reservation, it's a... the jewel along the Colorado River, it's a diamond shape, and it's just what it is. It's a jewel of a land. It is one of the richest land between Phoenix and the coast there, and the Colorado River runs right through it. In fact, some of the California water that Los Angeles drinks, the population there, is from the Colorado River. Isn't that wonderful? And so we are right below that aqueduct, and also above there is Lake Havasu City. And you know, we could have our own city down there, and we're developing it down on that reservation. Now, in regards to the society there, we have a reservation town. So many square miles was granted by Congress for a town. Townsite was created there. And you have non-Indians living there, and then you have the reservation group. And it seems to me that we have different caste system there, the white caste and the Indian caste system. But the Indian group itself has broken down into 2 separate groups, those who believe in the white society and those who don't. Those who don't want to sing their own songs and go their own way and... they have to go on the California side to sing. So they gather there every Sunday and they sing songs. This group of people are in terms of tribal government, and we do have a tribal government there and a tribal council there. They feel alienated. They feel aloof and apart from the council. And this creates a problem there. But it's still a potential. 98% of the people in our reservation spoke English in 1958. And right at this time, I imagine 100% of them speak English. But we still have the same old problems. They're still poor Indians, and a whole lot of them. So learning English and going through college doesn't mean a thing. At that point in time, when you have to return back to the reservation, you're not in the in-group. With a college education, one could be the janitor over there on that reservation if you don't go with the, don't follow the BIA policy or tribal policy, you know. So, but it's still positive. It's still a jewel. It's still land. And some of the other Indian people who really follow the Indian philosophy and the Indian way of thought are now beginning to get into the government. And slow. This last election, last year, a year ago, in December, 50% of the council there were under the age of 35. And we have a real young tribal council chairman there, about 27 years old. And this is great. There's a change coming, and it's going to be positive for our reservation. But I think that we're going to have to set up a cultural studies, studying about ourselves and learning to talk our own language again. Over.
Okay, well, thank you, Gabriel. I see that we're out of time for this part of the show, so we'll have to send this back to the local stations for about 15 minutes, and we'll return at 8. And I'd like to thank you, Stella and Gabriel and Ray, for being here and giving us your time. Okay, so... we'll return at 8 o'clock.
Machita, boy, I'm beady, machita.
Мочіта мойкан співає бі, мочіта моя піди, мочіта мойкан співає бі, мам піва, хока їма, та он та ніка і та ї, і ве мей віта ї, нам кая я не ладіте, мочіта моя піди, мочіта мойкан співає бі. Мачита моя пігіні, мачита мой канспела і вима піва, хока гіно, та хонта ні каї таї, і вене і таї, нам кая ляну ні важіце, нам кая ляну ні важіце.
Listening to A Moment in History, the occupation of Alcatraz Island in 1969 on From the Vault. For more information or hear more about the Occupy Alcatraz movement, please give us a call at 1-800-735-0230 or visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org. You can listen to this podcast now on fromthevaultradio.org.
This is the Pacifica Network, and this is Pacifica Berkeley. KPFA and KPFB. This is Al Silvowitz, the station manager at KPFA, and I'm in the studio with John Adair, professor of anthropology at San Francisco State. Professor Adair, your major field of interest is Indian culture and anthropology, particularly with an interest in the Indians. Have you got any reactions to the occupation of Alcatraz and to what's been said so far this evening?
Well, those that I've spoken with think that this is really a very significant event, and one that my friends have watched very carefully. Those of us in anthropology who have worked with American Indians in the past have been very much concerned with the fact that while the federal government's heart might be in the right place, doing things for Indians is no answer at all. And the Indians have shown in their moving in on Alcatraz, that they intend to do things for themselves, and that's what's the really important thing.
Well, I think that there may be a kind of over-familiarity with the horrifying statistics on the part of the young Indian people on Alcatraz, and that they don't lean on those in presenting them to our audience. I think there are many statistics and case histories and examples that could be given. The mortality rate significantly higher on reservations and things of this sort. Would you want to express some of those?
Yes, well, I don't have the statistics at hand. I could make some comments. The health situation for the American Indian nationwide has been deplorable. In some areas, since the United States Public Health Service has taken over, some conditions have improved. They've improved remarkably on the Navajo Reservation, which I am familiar with. On other reservations, I understand that they are still way behind in terms of rendering an adequate health service. But beyond that, there are other things that should be pointed out. There are very few American Indian lawyers, for example. There are very few American Indian college professors. There are very few American Indian professionals, although the Indians are coming into professional ranks more and more every year. But they have been a people, as has been expressed by the Indians on Alcatraz that spoke this evening. There has been an isolation of the Indians from the mainstream of American life, and now that the Indians are living in by tens of thousands in American cities, as a matter of fact, Los Angeles and Orange County have the largest Indian population, I believe, in the nation, of any equivalent of any comparable area, and Indians in cities is living in cities is something very new to Indians. And in the urban renewal, Indians frequently get left out in the cold. And I might add speaking of renewal, this seems to be on Alcatraz an Indian renewal. They want to find their own way of coping with the city and coping with conditions on their reservations from which they have been relocated.
The figure is often given of about 600,000 as the Indian population in the United States. I understand that this figure may not be accurate because many Indian people, as with certain other segments of the population, for example, young people who are designated as hippies, just do not get reflected in the census. They're not found. They're lost. But that figure of 600,000, even if we accept it as a kind of working hypothesis, what relation does that bear to the population of Indians as anthropologists have been able to estimate it prior to the advent of the white man on this continent?
Well, the Indian population in the last 50 years has been very much on the increase, and it is getting up to and perhaps will exceed the Aboriginal population. But the important thing is that at the present day, the Indian populations all over the nation are increasing very rapidly, and it's one of the most rapidly increasing populations in all of North America.
But it is significantly less, as I understand, than the number of Native Americans or Indians that were here when, let's say, the first people arrived from Europe.
I'm sure that's true, but I can't give you the statistics.
All right. I assume that was a significant factor because what that means is, of course, that the rate of attrition and death and destruction which occurred 100, 200, 250 years ago was a significant factor, I guess, in the inheritance and memory and legend structure and history of any individual Indian who's alive today.
Correct. This is one of the things that is in the mind of all of the American Indians, and another thing which was expressed this evening by those out on Alcatraz was the importance of Indians studying about themselves, as was said, a chance to educate themselves as to what their Indian heritage is. Now, in certain areas of the country, the American Southwest, for one, the American Indians' culture is still very much of a going concern. Their religion is still with them, and they practice their religion in their daily life. Their economics and their tribal structure and their social organization is still very much the way it was prior to the white man. But that's not so on the West Coast. It's not so on the East Coast and in many other sections of the country. And there you find that the Indians are essentially looking for an identity, and it's an identity that has been lost. And they want to really know what their Indian ancestry, how they lived, and what their culture was. And that was said and is said every day by American Indians, especially those living in cities.
I have this reaction every once in a while to the conservationists' actions on behalf of things such as redwoods and disappearing species of animals, that they're very concerned about this, as indeed I think is a large proportion of the population, as I am myself. But at the same time, I recall the very interesting, fascinating book called Ishi, which was really a description of the last remaining person from a tribal group, a group of human beings who lived in the state of California before the coming of Europeans, I suppose I should call them, because they were not all white, as a matter of fact. And I wonder about the feelings we have about the disappearance of intact, complete cultural groups which has taken place in the past. Groups of people who shall be no more, whose culture, whose human culture has completely disappeared except for artifacts.
This, of course, is the case not only with the American Indian, but it's true all over the world, in Southeast Asia, the mountain tribes, and in Africa. And wherever one would look at tribal life, one finds that with the passing of every year, a significant number of cultures are lost from the world. And that, again, I think, is the real significance of Alcatraz. The American Indian does not want to be lost. He does not want to be swept into the mainstream of American society. They do not want to be homogenized, as they say. And many anthropologists and many sociologists lately have realized the wisdom of their words in not wanting to get lost in the mainstream. What they need is their own thing and their own identity.
I'd like to ask you briefly about the field of Indian studies as it occurs in anthropology or related fields. Is that an area of interest amongst anthropologists and professional people in the academic field, or is this something which has gone into eclipse? I know there was a time somewhat earlier when this was considered a basic major field of study.
The American Indians, I want to be sure that I have your question. Is your question, is the American Indian as a subject in anthropology still a going concern? Is that your question?
Well, really, I think a little broader than that. The field of Indian studies, which would be, of course, I think, include the earlier study as well as the current situation.
Well, I'll answer the question this way. Prior to this, the anthropologists and other social scientists were those who, from the outside, had a great interest in the nature of Indian culture. In recent years, American Indians themselves have wanted to be participants in this study. And I think this is a significant new movement in anthropology itself that's just getting underway, what one might call in-culture research. And this also has, of course, a great educational value. Many of the same psychological characteristics that and pedantic, I mean to say the problem of the educator, educating various ethnic groups bears many similarities from one group to the next. And the American Indian, just as the blacks feel that, they must find out for themselves, and they must do a good deal of writing about themselves. Now, this is just getting underway among the American Indians. It was, to a degree, true in the 19th century. Many of the leading anthropologists in the 19th century were actually American Indians. But more recently, that has not been the case. And now the American Indian wants to get back to write his own history. This is going on at Rough Rock, Arizona, on the Navajo Reservation, where they are feeding back to the community and to the people the work of the anthropologists and interpreting that material in their own way. I think this is excellent. And the same thing goes in the classroom at San Francisco State or University of California at Berkeley or other places where Native American studies are being taught.
We've heard reference made to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and otherwise known as BIA, and I'm sure that we will hear it again many times as these programs progress. Could you perhaps describe what the Bureau of Indian Affairs is and a little bit of its history and relationship with the Indian people, just even in general terms, so our audience may have that in its mind?
Well, the Bureau of Indian Affairs started out, I might add, in the War Department in the last century. It was transferred over to the Department of the Interior and is a very large bureaucracy. It is a well-meaning bureaucracy. It has had some very brilliant leaders. John Collier Sr. was perhaps the most notable of any of the Indian commissioners. But the Department of the Interior has always had to be a defender of the American Indian against those who would make land claims against the American Indian and grab the land from him. And so the Department of the Interior has had many different kinds of roles. And there has been, of course, in the distant past, a good deal of corruption within the federal government. That has not been so in under the Collier regime and under recent Indian under recent commissioners. But nonetheless, it is such an enormous bureaucracy that it is very difficult for the Indian to get to have his own voice heard, even if an Indian commissioner is, even if an Indian himself is the commissioner, which is the present case, and the case of the last commissioner was also an American Indian. But the bureaucracy moves very, very slowly, and it's off in one little corner in Washington. The Bureau of Indian Affairs does not lead to other kinds of career jobs in the American in the life of the American civil servant. It's a dead end, and very frequently people just get lost in that bureau, and they do not become effective, and they become demoralized. The same thing goes for Indians who have joined the bureau.
We've got about a minute more before we go back to Alcatraz, and I'd like to ask you as a concluding question what your reactions are to the ideas that were promulgated as far as the use of Alcatraz. For example, the setting up of a Native American university. How do you react to that?
I think that this is a marvelous idea. I would see no reason why that cannot be done and done effectively at Alcatraz, here in the middle of the Bay Area, where there are excellent universities that have had a long interest in ecology and in American Indian studies. What could be a better site for such a university? And I think that from what I know and from what the Indians have said this evening, they want to extend their services and their educational services back to their reservation. And speaking of ecology, I think this in itself is another excellent thing about the takeover of Alcatraz by these Indians. It will be of great significance to see how they can relate to that environment and how they are able to improve that environment.
And this is KPFA and KPFB, Pacifica Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Network. We now take you back, live and direct, via radio link to Alcatraz.
Welcome back. This is Radio Free Alcatraz from Indian Land, Alcatraz Island in California. This is John Trudell speaking for the Indians of all tribes. And for this portion of the show, we have with us Mr. Richard Oakes, Ms. Lenaida Means, and Mr. Earl Livermore. Richard Oakes, as many of you may know, is a Mohawk Indian from New York, the St. Regis Reservation, Quebec, Canada. He's a council member now. He was with the initial invasion, and he's also a San Francisco State College student. And Lenaida Means is a Bannock Indian from Fort Hall, Idaho. And she's a college student also in pre-law at the University of California at Berkeley. And she was also one of the first 14 to land on the island. And we have also with us Mr. Earl Livermore, a Blackfoot Indian from Montana, who was just appointed coordinator for the Alcatraz movement. He's also the ex-director of the San Francisco Indian Center. He's an artist, and he has been with the movement from the start. And so the first question I'm going to lead off with, because Richard just mentioned it to me, is at this very moment, what are one of our most important needs on the island? Yes.
At this moment, we need water. Water was when we first came on, it was one of our most outstanding problems, and it still is our problem now. We had, as of 2 days ago, 25,000 gallons. Now it's down to a critical level, and we're in dire need of water.
Okay, so if there's anyone out here in the San Francisco area that can give us a hand about getting some more water, we sure would appreciate it. Earl, as an artist, what would you like to see develop with an art program on the island?
Well, we're already in process of looking for a site to develop an art studies program. I've had a friend of mine look at a site, and we're thinking of starting a program immediately if we can get the art supplies out here on the island. We'd like to work toward developing a culture center. We know that there are a number of Indian art organizations throughout the country that can help us as far as getting the art to the area if we want a national art exhibit.
Well, I think it's to people that know anything about the Indian people that Indians are just, as a race of people, naturally artistic, come out with many beautiful designs. As a matter of fact, one of the boys that's here for the conference today that we held is, spent the night at my house down here on the next level. And he did a painting this afternoon on the wall of an Indian riding a horse, and he did it in about an hour's time. You know, it's a very good job. He's never had any artistic training. And also, there's a gentleman from Canada. His name is Alan Sapp, and he's a Cree Indian. And he has just, he's starting to get public attention now as an artist. Neda, I had, what's this? Oh, being as you were one of the original 14 to come out here, one of the invaders, why did you join this movement?
Well, I guess it's a lifelong thing. You don't just, it's hard to say that you just jump into it and you join it. It comes from way back from the reservation, and the type of things you see your people going through, the type of things your family goes through. It's all affected me personally. And I guess that's why I went into the area that I did, and where I'm going to major in law. I mean, I'm in pre-law now, but I'm going to go into law later on. It's like I said, it just isn't something you jump into. It's something you've kind of grown up with.
Richard, same question to you. What motivated you to join this movement?
I have a similar answer to Nanita in that I was involved in the 1959 struggle on my own reservation, trying to blockade the building of the Long Sioux Dam, the Seaway Project, which was taking parts of our reservation up there without compensation. Also building of a bridge from the United States to Canada on the reservation, and building of facilities to house the maintenance men and the various aspects of the bridge, all on Indian land without just compensation. So it's really been a deep part of me to try to rectify some of these. Now we feel like we're in a position to do something about it.
Yes, it seems to me that the government has been practicing a policy of taking what they need from the Indian people, well, not necessarily what they need, taking what they want from us, just about any time that they would like to do so, and they've been doing this through the years, are doing it today. And I would say that a large majority of the people out in the average American people aren't even aware that this is going on. And maybe that's why the government is allowed to get away with this. We're just about out of time here, and I would like to say to the people in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York City, that all you have to do to help us with the Alcatraz movement is just write a letter. Write a letter to your congressman or to President Nixon, but write a letter and just say that you support what we're doing, because what we're doing here is not to advocate the overthrow of the United States government or anything else. What we're struggling for is a chance for our people, the same chance that everyone else seems to be fighting for today, but we have never had anyone to really kind of want to do the battle for us, so I guess we're going to have to do it ourselves.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. If you would like to join our campus campaign sponsoring school libraries across the country with programs like this, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org. or call us toll-free in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. This program was written and produced by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer. The series is executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives, and I've been your host, Brian DeShazer. And thank you for keeping our history alive.
Thank you to the Pacifica Radio Archives. The Friday edition is a production of KIDE Hoopa Tribal Radio. We thank you for listening.